of Matt and Mark Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
And this week's film is Nosferatu, released in 1922 by German director F.W. Murnau. Stars Max.
Is that the right pronunciation?
Murnau.
I don't know.
I don't even know if it's German. Terrible. Anyway, it stars the enigmatic Max Schreck as Herr Orlok. And Gustav von Wagenheim as Hutter. We have no intro music or intro dialogue because
it's a silent movie.
Silent movie. So
maybe what I should have done is that one time where twice that the clock is ringing.
The clock rang.
There's a bell sound in the from the orchestra.
Yeah,
that coincides with it.
There was another little sound effect too.
Oh, really?
You get some wind.
Really?
I got some wind, so let's talk about...
I guess
about...
that could have been like some of the woodwinds making a windy noise?
No, it actually sounded like a sound effect, because the... Well, let's talk about what versions we watched. We watched...
Okay.
I watched this on Netflix Instant. I think it was a rescoring from the late 90s. There were some synthesizers in there. There was some...
There were some synthesizers in yours?
A little bit.
We must have had a different version. I thought we would have watched the same version because
I checked out
the DVD, which was a... I don't have the DVD with me, but it was a reconstruction of the film from the late 90s, I believe. And I remember the cover of the DVD was the same as the cover image to use on Netflix. So I did look at the Netflix one briefly, but I didn't watch it.
Okay.
So but you said you had synthesizers. Mine was a... strictly an orchestra performance that went along with it.
Well, we may have heard two different soundtracks then, which actually is fairly common for this film. Unfortunately, we're inadequately supplied with credits to give you the orchestration history. It's been... I think there was a heavy metal band, Typo Negative, who actually did their own score of Nosferatu.
Oh, that you can listen to while you watch the movie?
I don't know. Either that or you... I mean, it's public domain, right? So you could...
Do what you,
you
want.
Go ahead and mash this thing up to, whatever levels you mm-hmm. want and put a DVD out. Fritz Lieber Metropolis, which I don't know when that came out, but I think most folks are familiar with Metropolis. If you're not, it's a German expressionist science fiction film. Kind of a future utopia, and there's a robot in it, then I forget the whole story.
I think I watched it once a long time ago. There was a big theatrical re-release in the late 90s, I believe.
Queen had scored it, the band Queen.
Rescored it?
Yeah, there was a...
Did that have a theatrical release?
Or was Queen and... I'm doing terrible here.
Hey, now, you gotta be positive. You're good.
You're doing enough.
A good job.
Yeah. Anyway, it was rescored with a rock soundtrack in the 80s, and it was kind of cut up a little bit more music video style. I don't know if it was really re-edited, but it was basically like an hour and a half long music video.
You saw it, though.
One time when I was younger. I don't remember much of it now.
Well, I'll tell you that watching this movie sort of put me off of the idea of going way back in time. To see silent movies, but this is maybe in the top 25 or so list of classic silent films.
I'd say it's number one. I can't think of well
there's like City Lights and there's other ones I've never seen.
Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, things like that. I just wonder if this is sort of the action movie equivalent of those.
I'd say this is probably one
is
of
this
those.
Is this the think about modern. Like Oscar Best Pictures, considering the Oscars are tomorrow from the time we're recording
this.
Oh,
that's right. And the silent movie is up for Best Picture.
And the silent movie is up for Best Picture. I have not seen The Artist. But think about back in the 20s. That I'm sure you had films of all type. You had more introspective films. You had more films that are more action-y, which I think this is more of what was the name of that? The Gladiator. It won Best Picture, right? It wasn't a great film.
No. It was
fun. I enjoyed it. I saw it.
It was definitely not Best Picture. I mean, Best Picture?
It did win Best Picture.
No, I know, but was it really worthy of Best Picture, or was it just trying to give Russell Crowe an Oscar because he didn't win it the previous year for, I think, the The Insider or something. There was some.
Well, whatever the case. Yeah. I'm just saying maybe this film, Nosferatu, is sort of like the Gladiator of its time. Considered a great film, but in its heart, not necessarily a great film.
You can't get away. Well, you can't get away from talking about Nosferatu's, I guess, legal history.
Oh yeah, I do like that. I mean, why don't we talk about you know how this film came about? Because when did Bram Stoker write Dracula? Was it the late 19th century?
I don't know the exact date, but he had long passed, I believe, when this film was released.
He was dead, and the copyright was owned by his widow.
His widow, right? Which I think her name was, I want to say Frances Stoker, something like that.
Okay, and they were British, right?
Yeah, he was a British writer, and you know this kind of. I figured this podcast might allow you to vent about our heavy-handed draconian copyright laws that are still in existence.
What?
Well, so
this is back in the day when things became public domain in 30 years or something along those lines.
Yeah, a mere 30 years. You know, I don't even know if the world's going to be here in 30 years, but so let's. I'm going to kind of summarize the legal history of Nosferatu. Nosferatu is a knockoff. I guess you could consider it a knockoff of the original Dracula story, and it's almost
considering that the original Dracula story is based on long-standing myths.
Correct,
and the words it uses, like. Nosferatu.
Well, yeah, the origin
are actual words that exist in the myths of European myths of a devilish creature that.
Yeah, I mean, Dracula was a composite of like the Vlad the Impaler, who was a kind of a Christian Orthodox. I don't know. Was he a? I mean, he was a. Was he a nobleman of the Balkans?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Who. Defended against the Ottoman invasions of whenever that was, and I you know, the Ottoman Empire was.
I don't know anything particularly about Vlad the Impaler.
Well, he was an especially brutal, tyrannical individual.
It'd probably be tough to find one that wasn't.
Exactly.
In those days,
he had, you know, he fit sort of the historic. Context of Dracula. So that's sort of the idea.
And he's also sort of a mix of a chupacabra-like figure as well, right? Sort of a demon of the night.
Well, his myth, obviously.
Beyond that, you're saying it's an amalgam.
Well, and the Romanians, to be stereotypical,
you're talking about the Roma or the Romanians?
I'm talking about the folks in the Balkans in general. There are lots of isolated mountain communities. Let me continue.
Okay.
There's lots of isolated mountain communities, small villages, lots of superstition. Eastern Europe is kind of rife with superstition. And when you have sort of this insular culture, you're able to create a lot of kind of whacked out myths. And to this day, I think you could go into those Romanian villages, those isolated villages. Those kind of like Borat villages, to be horribly stereotypical. And you would get a lot of folks believing in this sort of, still sort of like myths of vampires and, you know, all this creatures of the night, you know. So
I'll send this podcast over to my friend Serene from Romania.
Oh, boy. Yeah. And she's like, you racist friend. that was sort of where the myth of Dracula was born. And Bram Stoker, and Bram Stoker's story came out of that kind of composite mythology and history.
Well, I see him sort of doing what other people have done, let's say Tolkien, taking these myths and reshaping them and turning them to their own purpose, or even more modern, the Harry Potter books take a lot of these old creatures and reform them and reshape them into their own story.
Yeah, exactly.
These old ideas.
Yeah, because
Tolkien doesn't come out of a vacuum. There's
sure,
there's a raw material that these authors work with.
And Tolkien did that like masterfully with Anglo-Norse myth and created Middle Earth out of it. So Bram Stoker published his novel, and this was the first time film. I mean, I think all. Early films probably had source material with literature, but this is a probably the first more mainstream case of, because Bram Stoker was a fairly popular writer back in the late 1800s.
They took a popular work and it was adapted for the screen by, who was it? Henrik Galeen.
Screen credits? Oh, okay. Things had to be changed. In order to really justify producing the film without completely ripping off the source material.
Well, I think it was fairly brazen. It was pretty much straightforward that, yeah, this is based on that work.
Well, and the names, like Warlock, Dragon, I mean, it almost has the same kind of consonant, syllabic, you know, tone to it.
And the term Nosferatu is in the book.
Oh, it is, the original Bram
Stoker. It's an actual... Have you read the book?
I've only read one Bram Stoker novel, and that was The Lair of the White Worm.
How was that? You've talked about The Lair of the White Worm.
I read it... I'd seen the movie from, the 80s with... what was his name? What's his name? The ladies love that guy.
Matthew McConaughey.
No.
He looks good without his shirt on, I'll be honest with you.
Hugh
Laurie.
No.
From House fame.
No. He's Notting Hill.
Hugh Downs, 2020.
No. Damn it.
I know who you're talking about. The guy had sex with the black crack whore.
Right, and he was in Notting Hill opposite. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is awful. I hate when
Want his name?
Well, I mean, to slow everything down, I guess we could. Anyway, it was a film back in the 80s, The Lair of the White Worm, that was based loosely on the Bram Stoker original novella. Mm. So I had read the Bram Stoker novel, and
was it more of a novella or is it?
It was short, and writing was a lot different back in that era. Mm. A lot more, I would say, telling than showing as far as the storytelling was concerned. They didn't really immerse you in the moment. It was almost like somebody kind of sitting around telling you the story.
So was it told in like excerpts from people's writing, like as letters?
It felt like you were reading letters of somebody who was retelling a story.
See, you know, one thing I did this week, because I was worried about my understanding of this film, especially since it's an old film, the way it tells a story is going to be very different from modern film, which I think tends to be more novel-like. And I think we can agree that this film tells a story in more of the spectacle of the movie image way, which has some great moments, but also some real drawbacks into how well the story is really told.
Yeah.
But so what I did is I listened to, there's a something called, there's a organization called LibriVox, where they have people do dramatic readings of books and record it. And I listened to, and it's unabridged, I listened to about 4/5 of the novel.
Of Dracula.
I'm in the last scene basically right now, sort of the last act at the moment, sort of in the middle. I wasn't quite able to finish the book. But I did listen to most of the book. I just wanted to have something to play off of. And it's told as a series of letters and diary entries.
That makes sense.
From the various characters. They're always, it's always
well,
basically
when written. Hutter, who actually isn't Hutter, I forget what his real name is in the novel.
I didn't bring the novel names.
He writes letters to Ellen, who I don't know who the original actor or the original character is from Dracula. Mm-hmm. And he's writing letters. And so I assume that part of the novel is probably composed mostly of his letters, I would think. And maybe you can... Hugh Grant, by the way. Hugh Grant.
It is Hugh Grant. That's correct.
Lair of the White Worm.
So, you know, all these... Jonathan Harker is the solicitor in the novel that plays basically the Hutter character. He's a very different character. In the movie, Hutter's a sort of a carefree, sort of manly guy, really sort of stereotypical, wasn't a particularly interesting character from the film. He's like, I don't give a shit, I'll do whatever I like, I'm not worried about you hicks and stuff. In the book, he's actually a very quiet, introspective, and careful man. Okay. That is very observant.
Played very masterfully thoughtful. By Keanu Reeves in the Coppola-verse? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I think Keanu Reeves is probably a lot closer.
With a terrible English
to the
accent.
Actual, yeah. And then there's other characters like his wife Mina and Van Helsing, the a great Dutch physician and their friend Lucy, and there's other characters too.
To get back, let's continue with the legal history of Nosferatu. So Nosferatu was made almost at risk because they were making it with copyrighted material that was changed just ever so slightly to, you know, mask its true source material.
Because they did try to license the source material, is that not correct?
I don't know.
I had heard that they had.
Okay. They made the film. Court, Francis Stoker took him to court and won, which I think bankrupted the production company, or I believe they had.
Oh, really?
Or I don't know if it bankrupted them, but I believe they had to pay.
Mm.
And this is the crazy one, is that all copies of the film were ordered to be burned, and most of them were, except for the ones that had been distributed outside the country.
Oh, that's why there's so few copies out there.
That's why there's so few copies.
And these reconstructions had to be pieced together from various versions.
But to think about that a copyright lawsuit would have destroyed this film forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of influence that this film has had on noir and horror and pretty much film in general since would be completely gone culturally from the history books. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to take off on a copyright rant there.
Copyright encourages innovation and creativity by protecting the interests of the creators or people that have dutifully purchased those rights from the creator.
Well, there is. I mean, I do understand that we do need copyrights to protect. Let's talk. I mean, pop culture, which is films and music. I mean, popular music these days have a shelf life. I think we have to admit that a lot of material has a shelf life, where its economic viability kind of goes down exponentially. Like video games. That's an excellent example.
You know, I wonder. If it'd be interesting to look at various forms, I'm sure it differs from whatever the copyrightable material is, but let's say what time period, let's say for a film, let's say of the total monies that film would take in over, let's say, a century, how many years until you reach 99% of those total profits?
Well, right now, the way the film industry is working, those 99.9% of the profits come in the first 2 weeks, and after that, they don't give a shit. Well, that's why they make crap, because you can just hump it with marketing for a couple of weeks, crank out shit, get the teenagers in the theaters, and make your 90%, 80% of the film back in the first couple of weeks.
Okay, but when do you think you reach 99%?
Obviously, it depends on the film.
Could you say probably after the DVD release and the media licensing to television, like 5-6 years?
I don't have any statistics to
say. Yeah, I don't
either.
But I would say that 99% of the profits are reaped before the life of the artist plus 70 years.
70 years.
Yeah, that's the current copyright law in Europe. I forget what it is in the U.S.
Well, and that's the thing that I was actually found interesting, is that the copyright laws in Europe are much more draconian than they are here.
They've just been recently updated. The U.S. is supposed to update theirs as well.
Because Dracula is now in the public domain, but I believe in Europe it's still
different. Actually, there was just a Supreme Court a case in the U.S. where things could be removed from the public domain and their copyright given back to the owner of the copyright. So there's the idea that, in fact, we might push some of these works back into copyrightable state.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
The Supreme Court said it was legal.
Of course they would.
But my question is, why so much trouble for such a small sliver of the profits?
Is it pride?
I think it's just because there's more money to be
made.
Well,
here, let's talk
about
whether it's
a shadow of the money that has been made from a particular work, it's still money.
Let's talk about
the throwaway profit is sacrilegious these days.
Well, okay, let's talk. When did Steamboat Willie, the original Mickey Mouse?
It's like the early 30s.
Yeah, it was the 30s. It wasn't as far back as Nosferatu.
I think that's the only reason Nosferatu is not still in the public domain. Because basically, there's been nothing transitioning to the public domain for about 80 years.
Right. And
unless they have purposely fallen out of copyright from not being renewed by the owners. There's a renewal process that has to take place after 50
years. There's a couple of writers from the 20s, pulp writers. There's Edgar Rice Burroughs, H.P. Lovecraft, and Robert E. Howard, who coincidentally wrote horror. pulp horror back in the 20s, and they're all public domain now. Mm-hmm. So anybody can go publish an H.P. Lovecraft book. Anybody can go republish a John Carter of Mars book. You know, Disney just is going to release John Carter here in a month or two. Had to pay absolutely no market or no film rights or anything for that material.
Mm-hmm. That's good because
is that tank. For the benefit of? I mean, if H.P. Lovecraft and those guys were still under copyright and you had to secure film rights from the estate, I'm guessing,
or because, whoever is the rightful owner of that, because these are transferable rights.
Here's the question: is okay? You know, yes, there's money to be milked from owning copyrights that are from material that's over 80 years old. Does it diminish the work at all? And you know, I guess that's asking a different question than the one we're trying to ask.
I guess I'm not sure. I mean, the only real issue is money. There's nothing.
It all comes down to money.
Well, that's what most everything always comes down to.
It just seems bizarre that you can retain the ability to control. We're talking 80 years, 90 years old.
Yeah.
You know.
Now they want to push it longer. They want to push public domain back even further.
Like to when? Like back in time?
Yeah.
Like Mozart?
That's a long ways.
Well, I mean, you know.
Well, the idea of public domain made just. I think the idea is just to get rid of the idea of public domain, remove it. None of us have ever. I mean, it's the way it's set up now. I'm not sure if there's much that can be done about it other than a popular movement to return public domain back to something more reasonable, like 30 years. Rise of the Pirate Party.
Well, the thing is I understand copyright and I understand the need for copyright, but when the viability of something financially or money-wise has reached a certain point, like you get upset that we're paying $3 for 40-year-old crap movies, you know, on the internet. Like,
yeah, but I've also argued that they'd never be retransferred.
Well, maybe that's true.
I mean, if the Road Warrior had fallen out of copyright, we'd be looking at a digital transfer from a VHS tape, not a high-definition digital.
There is an incentive to preserve the original artwork with copyright.
There is, yeah. I mean, the thing is that it doesn't have to be there could be certain rules, like you lose certain rights over time. Like you lose rights to the story, but the original, you know, moving pictures retain rights longer.
Right.
Stuff like that. I mean, there's all sorts of ways you could do it. Right now, it's just the law is created to maximize squeezing every last bit of profit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Out of everything without allowing this material to be reprocessed creatively.
Right. And, okay, so we've kind of gone on a tangent, but we knew we were about the origins of the film.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting thing to see these same battles and how copyright can be used to the ill of society.
Yeah. Well, the thing is this film would not have been made if it was if they had to fight it out with the Bram Stoker's estate. And
well, they did. They did make it and did fight it out and lost.
They did it afterward, but they did make the film.
Well, that still happens to this day.
That's true. Anyway, let's get into the film a little bit. This is in the vein of German Expressionists. There was
what? It's in the vein of German Expressionists?
In Expressionism. This was a film of that genre of German Expressionism post-World War I. The thing about Expressionism, it's based on the fact that there was a lack of lavish budgets, and I think it had to do with a lot of the financial ills of the German Republic after World War I. So there wasn't a lot of money to do big budget films.
Because this does look like it's sort of done on the cheap.
Correct, yeah.
I'm just wondering how it compares. See, I'm not familiar with the silent movie area. I wonder how much it compares to the work of Hollywood at the similar time.
I think Hollywood was going nuts because there was huge budget films back then, like the original Ben-Hur. You know, I don't know when Howard Hughes did, was it Hell's Angels, which is this elaborate.
I would really
World
like
War
to
One air combat movie.
See, that would be an interesting movie. I'd like to see one of maybe that, or maybe Ben-Hur, you said?
Yeah, the original Ben-Hur.
I'd like to really do one of those at some point so we can compare the...
silent film era?
Well, the technique of sure. these two different groups.
Because
this does really see a sort of low rent.
So, Expressionism, it was born out of necessity. The set designs were wildly non-realistic and geometrically absurd. And with a lot of designs painted on the walls to represent lights, shadows, and objects. You don't see so much of that.
It doesn't seem like that
no,
quite in that case.
What they're kind of talking about here is a film that's, I guess, probably the seminal work of German Expressionism, which is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which I haven't seen, but mm-hmm. uses this to full effect with these kind of non-Euclidean set
okay.
designs and you know, it's all kind of done on the cheap, so there's a lot of shadows being used to sort of hide. And so
this film has a lot of exterior shots and quite a few. I mean, I would say most of the film is shot on real sets.
Exactly. So I don't quite know how it fits into that sort of idea of really non-realistic on purpose kind of filming of techniques. I mean, there's not... The sets are all more or less real.
Well, I mean, maybe it's just the storyline allows you to use real sets. I mean, there's a couple things like... The interior shots are by necessity sets because there's... I doubt this film requires heavy... I'm sure the film requires high lighting conditions.
Yeah, and that is the other thing. I mean, the silent film era, I don't know how the cameras... You know, I don't know what the sensitivities of the cameras
were.
Oh,
they had to be... The film had to be really slow, I'm sure.
In the case of Nosferatu, all the night scenes are actually filmed in the daytime, but they have a blue tint to them.
Yeah, tinting. Was your film tinted as
yeah,
well?
Because
I guess that was what they did with silent films. They tinted them to give them a sense of time.
Well, they tinted the blue for night, and obviously it's in stark daytime. I mean,
I don't think they could film it any other time.
They probably couldn't film. And this sort of, like in the 50s and 60s in westerns, I watched a lot of you watch a lot of 50s, 60s westerns, and one film that comes to mind is the Clint Eastwood movies. Night is filmed in daytime, but it has a really heavily tinted lens to it, so it's supposed to be moonlight. Obviously you see shadows and clouds, and it's definitely the daytime. They've just put a filter over it.
Yeah, it's still done to this day. You take the day and you stop the film down,
or you now like you moonlight or you have, you know, big lamps that synthesize the moonlight. It's nighttime filming outdoors is always artificial, I think, in film. And
yeah.
In certain cases you can do it right, but most of the time and especially in German expressionism,
there's no reason not to make it realistic. The sun as the moon, because you have control of the exposure. So you can basically turn the sun into the moon.
Yeah, exactly. You can turn it down. You don't have to turn it up.
Yeah.
So that was the case in Nosferatu for the night scenes. They filmed in daylight.
I doubt they had any option.
Yeah, and they just suggested using the blue tinting.
I guess that was commonly used at the time.
I'm sure it was.
It was, in fact.
The color...
There was a... little on the DVD, there was a little film about the restoration. They talked about tinting, in that they tinted this in the traditional method of tinting it.
Gotcha.
Though I still was a little confused sometimes with the tinting, because I was a little confused about what time of day it was supposed to be.
Well,
but also I think one thing about it is that this movie differs from the book in the fact that in the book sunlight doesn't kill the vampire. In the book, he just his great powers are diminished during the day, and he has to take the form of a man, and he doesn't have his supernatural powers during the daytime.
Right.
In the book, so he's still out and about.
Right.
He's not turning into a gas and flowing through walls,
transmorphing and stuff.
Yeah, and he doesn't have his great powers of he has the powers to put people into trances, and he doesn't have that during the day.
Gotcha.
But in this movie, they actually. You know, I wonder about the idea of the sunlight being deadly. to vampires? I wonder if
it originated in this film.
This is where that idea originated.
That whole rule that has percolated through pretty much every vampire movie since this movie was made started with Nosferatu. That's
before it was just the powers are diminished during the
correct. Day. So like you think about movies now, like Blade. An excellent example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have little UV grenades that flash and like burn up vampires. You know, they burn up once they hit daylight. Mm-hmm. The Twilight, I guess, remains true to form because they just twinkle in the daylight. They don't actually get burned up. So
what do they do? Have you seen one of these movies?
I told you this. We've gone over this. Yeah, I've watched the Twilight movies with the riff tracks.
Oh, I think I put it out of my mind.
Oh, okay.
The idea is anyway. So horrid. They actually, because they do go out in the day, don't they?
Yeah. They just twinkle, though, like weird ephemeral elves. Anyway. Mm. Pretty much every vampire film since has to have, like, the burned up vampire daylight scenes, or, you know, it's kind of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it started here.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting how, I guess, popular myths sort of come to... Nobody really knows how they start, but this one, the burning up in daylight thing.
Yeah, that very much differs from the...
Let me finish up with the expressionism here. The thing about German expressionism, a lot of the films dealt with madness, insanity, betrayal, and other quote-unquote intellectual topics. So this film fits that to a T, especially the insanity and madness part of it. Intellectual, maybe not so much. I guess you could think of it as like the original art house, you know. German expressionism was kind of the beginning of that. You know, that you could have maybe a more abstract sort of intellectual film, as opposed to just kind of retelling of simple stories, which is pretty much what predominated silent film in the early era, or comedies. You know.
I mean, I understand what you're saying. I just don't see it in this film.
This film seems like a bit
of an action film.
Well, there's a lot of madness and insanity going on. Knock, the real estate agent who...
being Billy Crystal going back in time and put in costume?
That sure looked like Billy Crystal.
It did look like Billy Crystal, did it not?
Oh, man. Well, the characters... We're definitely...
I don't see where Nock is any great expression. He's just some
he's
archetype, evil guy, I'm scheming, and then I went crazy. I just don't see it as being...
Oh, when he was in there, like, eating flies, that's probably in the Bram Stoker novel.
There's an insane person. It's a different character.
It's Renfield.
Renfield.
Is and is he just some dude in a prison that...
He's a guy that's gone mad, and he has some weird... He's preoccupied with... eating the energy of the life force of other creatures.
Yeah, so he's eating bugs.
And he has this weird connection with the vampire.
It's like a telepathic sort of...
Yeah, they're sort of both sort of evil, and the vampire's comings and goings influence Renfield then used for Van Helsing and his vampire hunters
as a
useful tool.
Gotcha. Anyway, so... I guess I've kind of blown my wad there on German Expressionism, but was in the vein of that.
We can go back and German Expressionism film. I'd be
interested. Yeah, we could go and see. I guess
I just don't see it in this film.
I'd like to go see Dr. Caligari.
Okay.
I think where the Expressionism, or at least the non-realism, or the absurd, is in the character of Count Orlok himself.
Well, that's the best part of this film.
Well, of course, and that's why this movie is so iconic. If you didn't have...
That's the timeless part of this film.
Is Orlok.
Yeah.
And Orlok is probably the creepiest fucking vampire that has ever hit the screen to this day.
Yeah.
You can never make somebody as fucking creepy as Max Schreck as Count Orlok.
Yeah, with all the other sort of stupid overacting characters in this, sort of anachronism to the time, Orlok is timeless in his portrayal.
Right. If you could dress up as Count Orlok today...
And put him in a film.
And put him in a film, and he would freak you the fuck out.
Yeah. You know? You could transplant him. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Let's get into the film a little bit here. The plot, I could go through the plot if
yeah, I mean, I got a little plot.
Do you want to summarize the plot for us?
Well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's
the story of Dracula, and who isn't really familiar with that.
It's a simplification of Bram Stoker's book. You know, a young couple, and he's a
real estate agent.
He's sort of like
before the internet. You had to actually like send somebody out to a client.
He's a guy that handles paperwork and it does things, handles the paperwork for transactions and whatnot. So he goes to Transylvania,
which I learned what reading up what Transylvania actually translates to word meaning wise. It means the land beyond the forest.
Okay,
because Sylvania is like a forest,
and
trans beyond or past. Okay. So Transylvania actually means the land beyond the forest for those who give a shit. But anyway, so
he goes. Anyways, Orlok inquires to buy a house in Germany.
Right.
In the book, it's in London.
Yeah.
And so,
what does he need to move? Does that explain it in the Bram Stoker?
He wants to go to new hunting grounds and reach.
That
kind
of made sense. Yeah.
And sort of bring. He'd been great in the past, but he'd been greatly diminished the last few hundred years.
He's getting a little hungry.
Yeah, he goes out and decides to start a new... He was a great lord, and now he's in a ruined castle. The idea that he wants to refresh and become a great influence on the world again.
Gotcha.
But anyways, he goes to meet Orlok in Transylvania to sign the paperwork, and he's double-crossed by Orlok.
Prison.
Yeah, to a certain extent. It's not really clear exactly what happens in the film, but Orlok just sort of takes advantage of him because that's his nature.
Yeah, right.
And Orlok goes to Germany. I forget what the name of the town is. By ship, strangely enough.
They call it Bremen in this plot synopsis. I thought it was like Viborg. Maybe that was the actual town it was filmed in. I don't remember. Anyways,
Orlok packs up a bunch of dirt, which they don't explain in the film, but it's explained.
That's where he gets his power, right?
Yeah, he needs it to... He's undead, and so he needs to... that's how he rejuvenates himself, by sitting in basically the dirt, the graveyard dirt where he was buried.
Okay, yeah.
And in the book, there's 50 cases of it. And there's
there's more coffins than necessary.
They're actually just big wood... In the movie, they're just big wooden box. The idea that in the book is that Dracula, he's much more cunning than how he's displayed here in the film.
He's a one-man show in Nosferatu. He doesn't have any...
But he hires people, but he does still do most of the things himself.
Does he hire, like, crazy stereotypical gypsies as his minions?
He does hire gypsies in Transylvania, but anyways, in the book, the idea is that he takes that soil and puts it all over the place, so he has... Anyways, that's beside the point. Anyways, he comes to which is actually pretty cool, with some stop motion animation.
Yeah, I noticed some early special effects that were quite amusing.
There's the stop motion stuff with that show basically telekinesis on the point.
Yeah, the coffins all stack up by themselves on the horse carriage,
and the carriage drives itself.
And then there's the when on the ship when the hatch opens by itself. And the rats start pouring out. It's like a simple stop motion to get the...
Oh, the hatch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also some double exposure to sort of give a ghostly image of Orlok.
Yeah, like he walks through a wall when he shows up in
also with the madness
Germany.
of the sailors see his image sort of
and then
ghostly.
He disappears.
Yeah,
right.
That's pretty neat.
Right.
Anyways, he comes to...
Bremen, I guess.
Whatever that town in Germany is. And let's see here. At the same time...
kills the whole crew of the ship.
He kills the crew of the ship, which he does in the book. And Hutter escapes, has some health problems because he fell 5 feet. And
nursed back to health by...
And he goes across land while Orlok is transported by boat around the coast.
Sure.
He goes across land, and they both basically get to... this German town at the same time.
Okay.
And, Orlok becomes fascinated with Hutter's wife.
Yeah. He well, he's like, she's getting, like, telepathic cueing from Orlok as he's, well...
Or she has a weird, like,
A bewitching. She's bewitched.
It's almost like she is... telepathic to a certain extent. Because remember when they are in Castle Orlok, and Orlok is thinking of feeding on Hutter once again, she has some power to intervene in that. She feels Hutter's danger.
Okay.
And somehow her power forces Orlok off. Remember, because Orlok
doesn't
feed
again. Wasn't
he
entranced by her beauty?
Maybe. But he was distracted enough where basically he leaves, loads himself on that cart, and heads out.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't feed on Hutter a second time.
Yeah.
So she does have a weird connection, and, you know, there's not a whole lot to it. I mean,
he shows back up, and he shows up in Germany, unloads his own coffin, and hoofs it off to the house. Mm-hmm. Unleashes.
Yeah, he's walking around with a big.
I know. It's like, man, he's like a DIY guy, you know.
He is a little bit of a DIY guy.
I mean, why couldn't you get...
I like him just walking around with that big case.
He's like, doo-doo-doo.
That still must have been pretty fucking heavy.
Well, yeah, he's a supernatural, you know.
I mean, just for the actor, even if it was empty.
Oh, it was probably made out of, like, balsa wood or cardboard.
Yeah, maybe so.
I don't know if they had cardboard back in the Weimar, post-Weimar, you know, Germany. But, so, yeah, he then occupies it. And then he goes crazy nuts feeding on the town, which they then blame on the plague of rats.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. They talk about the plague, and it doesn't seem like he could feed on enough people to kill all those people. Remember, there's basically a undertaker going through the town.
Putting crosses on the door for the dead.
Putting crosses on almost every door.
Those are the dead folks, right? I was trying to figure that one out.
He's not feeding on that many people. Maybe he did.
They called it the Great Death, so there was a lot of people dying.
Yeah, and
there's
even interstitial that talks about the marks on the... I can't see him feeding on so many people. It happens over the span of just a few days.
The pacing's a little off.
And also,
I'll give it that.
As the boat goes up, there's an interstitial that talks about at every port that boat stops at, there's a great plague. It's like at night he goes out like Santa Claus.
Yeah, he's like the Santa Claus of...
Bloodsuckers.
Bloodsuckers,
he like stops time and visits every house and kills half the people. Doesn't totally make sense. It's certainly not part of the book.
Not really.
I don't quite understand the whole plague business.
That actually, I believe, was an addition to the film that wasn't in the original.
Yeah, there's
Bram
no
Stoker's.
Plague. In fact, Dracula's movement goes unnoticed by the population.
Well,
because he feeds on very few people. In fact, he doesn't kill them when he feeds on them. He just takes some blood out of them.
But they're dying? Yeah, there's a little bit of a confusion. I mean, he does travel with the plague of rats, and so maybe the
he does have some rats in the book. But he controls all beasts are bent to his will.
Yeah.
Rats and otherwise.
There's the images of Orlok, which freak me out. But I hate rats, and rats freak me out. So the rats pouring out of the coffin and out of the hold freaked me out. Because I just hate rats so much.
Yeah, they just seem pretty tame rats.
I just hate rats, man. You kill rats every day, so you're a little less susceptible to it than
How about early on? Actually, rats are pretty nice. How about early on in the movie, before Hutter actually gets to Castle Orlok, where he decides he's warned by the person at the end, you better stay the night because the werewolf's out.
Oh, I love that.
Then they have the shot of that cutest little wolf
I've
ever seen.
Well, it's a hyena.
Yeah, it's not even a wolf.
And I don't know what kind of hyena it is because it doesn't look like the hyenas I see.
It almost looks like some sort of fox or something.
Yeah.
I think it must be an interbred animal.
It's kind of stocky. It doesn't have that weird long neck that hyenas have.
And he looks worried. That's supposed to be the werewolf that everybody's scared of.
The little hyena running around.
With his tails between his legs.
You do what you can. I mean, I'm sure a lot of folks back watching this movie had never seen a
thing
hyena
like that,
at all.
Certainly didn't look scary. So, not as scary as the very tame rats swarming around, which I didn't find scary at all, but you did.
Yeah, I hate rats. So I guess to summarize the plot there, so he goes on a killing spree in the town.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen basically baits him.
Who looks like Tina Fey, by the way.
Yeah, she kind of has an old-timey look to her.
Tina Fey?
Kind of a little bit square jaw.
Yeah.
Baits Orlok and keeps him occupied until sunrise.
By allowing him to feed on her. And see, I don't see where the film basically says it was a conscious decision on her
No,
part.
I didn't know what was really going on.
I mean, it's said that that's the conscious decision when people write about it, because she finds the book that explains the Dracula.
It seems like a sacrifice that isn't really...
Well, the book tells you the only way to overcome this vampire is to by the woman to keep him occupied by feeding till the cock crows.
Okay.
I mean, that's what it's an interstitial set.
Oh, and then she just says, well, that's time to get busy. And
is that what she does? Because it doesn't...
That's what it says, that feel she like offers scheming. Herself to Orlok.
Yeah, I guess so.
Deliberately keeping him entertained until sunrise.
Well, maybe that's what the movie was trying to portray with that.
At the cost of her own life. So I guess she dies.
And she does die.
Oh, she does die.
That's She's right. looking real healthy, but then all of a sudden she collapses and dies.
Yeah, and that old-timey kind of...
And then the doctor goes like this. Right at the end of the film, you see the doctor is outside the bedroom. Where
for the podcasters, describe what you just what your gesture was.
Oh, I'm just rubbing my
rubbing your chin and
my
shaking
beard
your head.
On my chin and slowly shaking my head. And you see Hutter mourning over his dead wife on their on their bed, and he's shaking his head slowly. The doctor going, "Oh, what a terrible thing!" And then there's a shot of Castle Orlok. And then the film ends.
Sequel time. Yeah,
I guess so. There should have been another bat flying around Castle Orlok. Doom, 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 yeah.
Doom. That, so the plot, fairly straightforward. It was obviously adapted from the original Dracula. The pacing, I think we've already said, is a little bit off. Like, things happen.
It could be the case that some of the original film was lost. And this is a reconstruction. So you wonder about some of... I heard that many edits of this film existed. But you wonder how close this is to what was originally the original edit by Murnau.
Well, who knows? Yeah, because, you know, they probably... Yeah,
there's only
sliced
so much
and
film.
Diced it, you know, for reels, and who knows? Yeah. So so there's only about 9 minutes of actual Count Orlok...
oh, really?
Footage in the there's not a lot of Orlok doing his thing.
Huh. You see, such a heavy part of the film. He feels more.
Well, fun. Orlok is just such an ominous, creepy ass looking dude that every time you see him, he takes your breath away a little bit. And I'm trying to think what's so freaky about the Max Schreck.
Well, he's
Orlok.
So tall.
He's tall, and he's just like
and
crazy
they have
thin.
Great pads on his shoulders, so it looks like he has almost no neck.
He's great. He's crazy thin.
He's thin.
He wears that coat that goes down to his knees.
And he drives a buggy like you wouldn't believe.
Oh, that's a freaky
with
scene.
Some fast forwarding.
That's freaky though, isn't it? When Hutter shows up at the castle, the Dracula, the Orlok carriage shows up, which is in the book, and I think. But is it? It's a. There's nobody driving it, right? In the book.
No, in the book, it is Dracula in disguise because he has no servants.
That's okay. So it was the same thing.
Exact same thing, and it does go fast, but not quite silly like.
Yeah,
that.
and every the carriage is draped in black sheets.
Uh-huh.
The horses are draped in black sheets.
Yes,
and Orlok has that. Funny little like Romanian villager hat on, and like his nose, and his nose is like he has his whole mouth crunched into his like coat collar or something
to
like
hide
that.
His identity.
Yeah, and his eyes are all kind of they're a little bit more black.
Yeah,
know?
and the main character realizes that it was Dracula driving that.
Yeah,
at once time goes on.
So that's the first time you see Orlok as. Kind of the count in daytime. Uh-huh. Well, I guess it's night because
it is night because it's blue tinted.
Blue tinted.
Yeah, it is a little confusing, and I think that since we're not used to these tinting cues, maybe it was easier for the audience at the time to understand what they were trying to get across.
A little bit of suspension and disbelief that you know. Yeah, I mean
that's all film.
Come on, you're seeing shit move on screen. I mean, you know, goddamn, what do you want?
Yeah.
So yeah, then they do business, and then you see Orlok again, and that's when Hutter cuts his finger.
Mm-hmm.
But then after that, you see the full-blown Count Orlok.
Well, after that, Orlok puts Hutter into a trance and feeds on him. Because you remember, he wakes up in the chair.
Right. He's like, mosquitoes.
He's checking his, he has a mirror, and he checks, oh, there's a couple of marks. And he writes that letter to his wife that the mosquitoes are terrible here. They bit me very close together on the neck.
So the Orlok look, and obviously, you probably wouldn't be listening to this.
Orlok does, Dracula does not feed on that character in the novel.
Oh, he doesn't?
No.
Okay. Obviously, if you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you aren't familiar with the Nosferatu look, but when he's in full-blown vampire mode, he's bald, kind of pointy, elf-like ears.
Yeah. But yet he looks pretty close to how he's described in the book, except in the book he has a big bushy mustache.
That would have looked terrible.
He
looks,
and plus he has a lot of hair on top of his head too.
Okay,
he's hairy.
The nose on Count Orlok, I wonder if that's Max Schreck's original nose.
It looks like a prosthetic.
Crazy-looking beak on that dude.
Oh, he's got a big hook nose.
Big hook nose.
Those Germans hate the Jews.
Oh. No, maybe he got something there.
He does sort of look like those Jew caricatures a little bit. You see from the time.
Oh, yeah. Like,
especially throwing the Third Reich.
Oh, right. Those terrible caricatures that the Third Reich would do about the Jews.
I wonder... Because this movie was part of the popular culture at the time. I wonder if they took this, and this was a German filmmaker, and somehow used the image of Orlok as the image of the Jews to strike terror and hatred.
Bloodsuckers feeding off of society. I
wonder what happened to this director during that time.
Was he Jewish?
I have no idea.
Watching this, though, it was almost more ominous watching the film because about what was to befall Germany 10 to 20 years later.
Yeah.
You know, because you're watching it, and it's strange watching really old films when, you know, history is long since kind of moved. You know, it's in history. And kind of the zeitgeist of the area, what, to use a German phrase, you know, what was the attitude? Were they scapegoating Jews for... like the financial downfall of Germany World War One? Then what was the attitude?
That was something that the National Socialist Party brought to the forefront. I don't know. I don't remember.
Well, it was a scapegoating of the financial ills of Germany that they used the Jews.
It was a political maneuver by the National Socialist Party.
Sure.
To gain power.
Right.
And so I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at.
No, I just I don't know if that attitude had percolated into something more, you know. I mean, obviously there was superstition about Jews and gypsies in Europe. They've always been an ostracized group of people.
Yeah.
I wondered if it was kind of it was ramping up, so to speak, for, you know, when obviously Hitler took over and, you know, Kristallnacht, and let's kind of make it a national policy at that point.
I don't know.
So, interesting, though. Interesting idea.
Wonder if they did, because some of those... I mean, there's a couple of real classic images you see in textbooks. And they have sort of an Orlok
look to them. Yeah, they would... I mean, they, you know, when they really got...
Some of the propaganda.
When they really got the Final Solution ramped up, they would put out these How to Spot a Jew booklets with these just terrible caricatures of, you know, Jewish features that made them look like Count Orlok, almost.
It'd be interesting to see if there's really a direct connection there.
What I also find interesting is when Knox sends Hutter off to Romania, he goes, "You're going to the country of thieves and ghosts." Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I get the ghost part, but the thieves?
The gypsies.
The gypsies, so, you know. Well,
look,
I'll tell you what.
I've heard first-hand stories of gypsies being real pain in the ass.
Well, you've never been to Paris, but if you want to see gypsies doing their thing.
Yeah.
Go to the streets of Paris. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And they're all out there swindling tourist spots.
Yeah.
I mean, well, Sarkozy said, let's ship them out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give them, like, he would put them on a planes and deport them to Romania, but it's the EU, so they could just get on a bus and come back. So it never really did much. Actually, I think a lot of folks were using it to probably just go home and visit family.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get deported by Sarkozy, and then I can, you know. of course, more of the progressive institutions of France went up in arms about that.
Well, so. I don't know. I mean, you got to put limits on your tolerance somewhere. That's all I got
to
say.
They're not hard to spot, I'll tell you that. They sincerely look like gypsies. You know, the Roma are, you know, they wear... Their look hasn't changed a great deal from the...
Well, from what I hear, I don't see why people wouldn't want to discriminate against them, no matter how distasteful people might
find it. It's definitely... The swindling part is definitely cultural. I mean, it's definitely in their...
The idea is that they're marginalized so much that they have no other choice for employment.
It's just, I don't know. I'd really like to know more about...
The Roma people?
I know where they came from.
My Romanian friends don't speak
Highly.
Don't think highly of the Roma.
Well, they have a musical tradition, obviously, that people enjoy. I mean, there's
Well,
gypsy music, I think, is, you know, it's definitely its own thing, I think you can go see authentic gypsy music in a large part of Europe. I think there's gypsy Roma that play a lot of music that, you know, I can't really sing.
I don't know. They sound like real assholes. I'm glad there's not around here.
Yeah, it's just like, well, it just goes against your grain.
That's
that
the nice thing
discriminate
about
and stereotype
yeah,
and be
that's
prejudiced.
That's the great thing about Washington, man. Western Washington. There's no
Joan gypsies to discriminate.
There's no gypsies and there's no blacks. Oh, sorry.
Well, oh man, we're gonna get in trouble if our five listenerships grew up to 10. So, interesting point though on the look of Count Orlok, and if it was in kind of a despicable, stereotypical look of the shunned people of the day.
Yeah, we really went on a long tangent on that.
I know. Yeah. So anyway.
But you know, one thing I like about the film, let's get off this topic of
yeah,
race.
We're getting in trouble.
My jokes are already getting too absurd.
That's right.
You know, I think one thing, the only, other than the Orlok character in this movie, because I can't say I really like this movie all that much.
Gene and I were
sort of laughing at it.
Oh, I was too. And
especially some of the overacting by Billy Crystal,
yeah, Billy Crystal.
And Hutter.
Yeah.
Terrible
oh, yeah.
character. Oh, wow, wow, wow.
They kind of had to do that, though, in the silent movies, right?
And it was a holdover from stage acting.
Well, you didn't have any words to express, so you had to definitely over-caricaturize yourself. You
know? Well, whatever the case.
Sure.
Other than the scenes with Max Schreck. And the other element of this film that I really enjoyed was the use of shadow.
Yeah.
And that's something I think that, I don't know if it's, I'm sure that the idea of using shadows ominously wasn't created for this film, but it is pretty early. And it is interesting that, you know, the director decided, you know, I have this ability to do things with shadow. So let's incorporate that into the story where that sort of the shadow is an extension, sort of a extension of his power. And it's also a very good visual technique. Obviously, the most important part of the scene is at near the very end,
the stairway scene
where where Schreck comes and you see Hutter's wife. She's lit with an extremely bright spotlight so he could get a crisp shadow of his hand, and the hand creeps up and grabs the heart, and she faints.
Right He was also that stairway scene where he's coming up the stairway and you see his like long fingernails and his ears and upcast against the you know, which you're supposed to, that's like he's almost moving as a shadow to like rematerialize in her room.
Because in the book he moves as a mist.
Right.
A lot.
Yep.
He actually sort of takes the shape of a mist or a cloud of dust to move where he will. So he sort of reinterprets that as a shadow because, well, he has the ability to film that. So I think, you know, in addition to the Schreck's costuming and portrayal, and maybe some of the stop motion that I enjoyed, I think the other is the use of shadow that I think. If this film lacked those things, it would be just Dreck, I think.
Yeah. It has to be. I mean, the film had to be iconic to last this long. It wouldn't have done otherwise.
Yeah, and I think those are the iconic things.
I mean, you know,
it's Orlok and the shadows.
If you go back to the 30-plus films of Dracula films that have been out there, there's people that come close that are maybe better than others. Like at one time, Bela Lugosi was played Dracula. Christopher Lee in the Hammer films, I believe, played Dracula.
Hammer?
Hammer Horror was it's called Hammer Horror. It was a production studio back in the 60s that produced really exploitative horror films that were kind of the matinee films of the 60s.
Sort of grindhousey?
Yeah, real grindhousey. My uncle, who's about 13 years younger than me, had like a whole kind of like coffee table book from when he was a kid of Hammer horror films. It was like, you know, stepping through, you know, the classic Hammer Horror. Anyway, it was a big production house.
Okay, I've never heard of it.
That did horror back in the 60s. And Christopher Lee was a part of that, and he was he played Dracula. Frank Langella, I don't think I've seen that.
Which version is that?
I don't know. And the latest was Gary Oldman in the
Bram Stoker's.
Bram Stoker's, yeah, he had to put the official label on it.
No, I'll be honest with you, I'd be interested in visiting some of the other. I mean, it's a very iconic character, and it certainly gets off to a great start in motion pictures by Max Schreck here in this film. It'd be interesting to see some of the other portrayals of him by other actors.
Well, obviously none have really kind of made as much of a mark because you would know of them by now. You wouldn't, he would have been surpassed by one of these more recent incarnations of Dracula, I think, at least in my opinion. Mm.
I don't think I've ever seen it, but I'd like to see the Herzog 70s film with Klaus Kinski as playing Orlok. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
I mean, Herzog's a great director, and Kinski's a fucking maniac.
Yeah, he's a maniac. Yeah.
Sounds like a good combination to me.
Yeah. Well, no, I'd like to see it. I mean,
at some point in the future.
We'll check it out.
It'd be interesting to play it against this one.
Right.
Plus, I'd like to do Shadow of the Vampire at some point.
Yeah. Which is a really great Max film. Schreck is being played by Willem Dafoe, right?
Willem Dafoe plays Max Schreck.
And Murnau is played by the ever-crazy Malkovich.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that film, and I hadn't seen any of this work before.
I hadn't either.
In fact, I don't think I had seen this film.
I thought I had,
but you know what I was remembering were scenes of the film from Shadow of the Vampire where they recreated some of these scenes.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, I've seen in montages and cut-ups the Nosferatu footage from... Mm-hmm. This is the first time I'd seen it. Actually, you know, full blown. Mm-hmm.
Beyond these iconic scenes, like Orlok coming out of the box.
Yeah. Oh, Orlok coming out—that's a great one. Yeah. Where he has like some kind of mechanism that lifts him straight up out of the box. Yeah. There was another scene where he was coming out of the tunnel back in Romania, or back in his castle in Romania, where he comes to meet Hutter for the first time. And he walks out of the black, and it's just, you know, that's the first time you kind of get him in the full light. And I think he's Orlok at that point. I don't believe he's the Nosferatu. Maybe he is the Nosferatu.
I guess I'm not sure why. What difference are you making between Orlok and Nosferatu? The same person?
Well, no, but he does transform into the Nosferatu. His fingernails get long.
Oh, do they?
He grows the teeth.
Oh, he doesn't always have the teeth?
Well, no, he's a lycanthrope, so he turns into the Nosferatu.
Oh.
He's not, I mean...
I guess I didn't notice that.
Mildly disguised. He's definitely changed.
He just changed when he's ready to feed, when he's taking...
Yeah, his fingernail and his fucking fingernails.
Like the scene where he comes to do his second feeding on Hutter, but is turned away by some power of the wife.
Right.
Where he's in the doorway in his shadow, and he's standing there filling the door.
Yeah,
that's a great scene.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, basically all the scenes with Schreck in them.
They're all
so that, and then some of the shadow work, and that's pretty much what you see in the cut-ups.
Yep.
And the rest of the film, I have to say, is rather disposable.
And
except for Billy Crystal.
Crystal.
I did enjoy his performance.
Well, let's see. Is there anything else we can say about Nosferatu? Would you recommend everybody go out and see it who might not have seen it?
Well, God, it's tough to say. I mean, you're going to have to take it with a grain of salt. You know, certainly there's something more to these movies than being entertained.
Obviously.
It's seeing a bit of history. So you got to take it from that standpoint that there's so much anachronism that sullies the film.
Well, the movie's 90 years old.
Yeah.
And the fact that you and I would sit down and watch it again, mm-hmm. I mean, that says something, obviously, too.
But it's not the same as reading a book that's 120 years old. Because the format's very mature by that point, the idea of the novel.
Right.
So this is the immaturity of motion picture. So there's all those growing pains.
Well, the special effects, obviously, but you can forgive them for that. But some of the montage stuff, You know, there's some montage sequences where you have interspliced scenes, you know, like the ship sailing and Hutter traveling, and you get some sort of these.
There is quite a nice ship, I mean, shot where he puts the camera on the prow of another ship and does like a run by.
Yeah,
it's actually a pretty nice little shot. Right. It probably was a real pain in the ass to set up.
Right. Yeah. And
but you got, I gotta say though that, I mean, the you know, the immaturity of film as an art format is unavoidable in this film. It's simply not a mature art form.
And unfortunately, I think that's why I'm biased towards older movies. I have issues with pacing, like even, you know, the talkies, you know, 30s, 40s. I'll watch them. Because a lot of the films that I would watch that are that old are influential, seminal classics. But to watch them on pure enjoyment is hard for me because I'm used to a certain pacing. And I'm not talking about the frenetic action movies we have today.
Make you so sick they cut so many times?
Exactly. I'm more talking about just kind of the, you know, the editing process that – and it's different with a silent movie because you don't have dialogue and things like that. But It's hard to sort of digest the awkward pacing of a lot of older films as an immature art form.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some films out there that are mature and would be made the same way today.
Well, Citizen Kane back in the, when was that made?
The Third Man.
I've never seen The Third Man.
I think if you were to make it today, you couldn't make it any better.
Really? Okay. I did watch in film class when I, back in,
this film would never be made the same way today.
No, it wouldn't. No. Sure.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that if you went to make a silent film like The Artist, which maybe I should go see The Artist, to see all the modern sensibilities
in the back silent era.
In those limitations of the technology. It'd be right. Interesting to see.
In film class, I watched Battleship Potemkin, which I think is probably it was political propaganda back. Was it in the the Bolshevik Revolution, I think, was when it was made. But it's a propaganda film. Silent, hard and to watch, and not a very good film. Mm. But it was made, you know, it's sort of a time and a piece of history and film that a lot of people watch. And, you know, uses a lot of those kind of early techniques that then get fleshed out later for film. But
yeah, and this film has that.
Not too. A fun movie to watch. It's painfully slow, over dramatic, and I would never say, oh, you got to go see Battleship Potemkin, you know, like I would recommend a lot of older films. So.
Yeah, no, that's the attitude you have to take to this film, I think.
Yeah, you have to put it into context, or you're not going to be able to really enjoy it.
A couple
it that
decades,
much.
I think, maybe, I don't know, we should go back. Maybe Metropolis, I don't know. Maybe there's some films from this era, maybe some of the Hollywood films that are totally mature.
Right. Let me say one more thing on Nosferatu before we finish up the podcast here. And it goes back to my bitch and complaint about Twilight by Stephanie Myers, which I can rip into constantly. But when did vampires stop fucking being evil bastards that you should fear? There's been a point in recent pop culture where vampires are humanized and romanticized and are, you know, just mixed up souls who happen to feed off the living. But back in, there was a point where vampires were fucking scary monsters that you should, you know, run for your lives when you see one. Mm-hmm. And I almost blame Anne Rice to a certain point because she definitely romanticized the vampires with Interview with the Vampire back whenever she wrote that novel.
Yeah.
And ever since, we've had to humanize vampires when they're actually the opposite of humans. They're more animals than they are, anyway. I mean, I can get into an existential.
Well, the idea is that you take these stories and who do you identify with? The idea of identifying with the vampire.
I love scary-ass vampires. That's my problem. I love when they're freaky and scary, and when they're not, then I get frustrated.
It's weird about the like the Blade movies where they mix the two. They humanize some vampires.
And make some just fucking evil as shit. Yeah, like in the second film, the new vampire edition, which are those crazy ones that their jaw splits open and they almost, those are more Nosferatu. Like they're all bald and they have the pointy crazy ears and the freaky eyes. Yeah. So they've almost had to bifurcate the vampire genre a little bit to make the more Nosferatu-looking vampires, and then make your more like, you
know, they've weakened the vampires, too. They don't have as many powers as they used to.
Well, not like Orlok. Holy shit, Orlok can, like, control people thousands of miles away and, you know, totally lay waste
to
whole towns.
A vapor.
Exactly, Anyway, next week's movie, we're going to review The Wicker Man of 1973, not the Nicolas Cage version.
Oh, shit, I watched the Nicolas Cage version. Can we just do that one instead?
Fuck it up now. You're just going to keep thinking about that.
No,
anyway.
No, I haven't watched either one.
The Wicker Man from 1973, we'll be reviewing that one. And it's one of my favorite films, and I don't know if you've seen it.
Nope.
Okay, so.
I don't even know what the story is.
Keep it that way.
Okay, great.
Anyway, until next week.
Have a good one. All right.